Rick Steves writes of a profound experience he had while on a family trip to Europe as a teenager. It was his realization that traveling is more than just moving from place to place to see the sights. It's learning about other people in a way that teaches you something about yourself. That insight developed into a career for Rick Steves of showing others about traveling. He spreads the travel gospel through books and tours, and on Travel with Rick Steves on AM 580 and Rick Steves Europe on WILL-TV. I'm Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, we'll hear from Rick Steves in an encore presentation of his appearance on the show from earlier this year. Focus continues right after the news. Good morning, I'm Jim Meadows, and this is Focus on WILL. You're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous Focus program. While we're not taking calls this hour, you can join our conversation on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. Rick Steves is about my age, but there's a big difference between us. I have hardly traveled anywhere, and Rick has traveled just about everywhere. Rick turned his passion for traveling into a career. He travels to see the world, meet new people, and show other people how they can do it. You can learn a lot about traveling at his website, ricksteves.com. That's Rick, STEVES.com. And on his programs, Republic Broadcasting. They both air Saturdays, on WILL Radio and WILL TV. And right now, Rick Steves is our guest on Focus. Rick, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jim. Nice to be with you.
And, you know, the first question that came to mind is, where have you been most recently?
Oh, most recently, you know, where was I just recently? I've been in Italy. I made a lot of new TV shows in Italy. And the big news for me is next month I'm going to Egypt and then Israel and then Palestinian territories and Turkey. So I'm going to be heading off to the Eastern Mediterranean. But for the last 30 years, for 4 months a year, I've been in a rut. I just go to Europe and I spend April and May in the Mediterranean. Then I go home in June and then I go back north of the Alps in July and August.
Is that travel in Europe for yourself or for professional reasons?
Oh, everything I do is my work. I love it, and it's just my, you know, people say, why don't you take a vacation? Well, I like my work so much. I go over there, and I spend 120 days a year in Europe. About two-thirds of it is researching my guidebooks. I've got guidebooks for every country in Europe, and they need to be updated. And I've got a staff of 80 people that help me do that. There's guidebooks for every country, so it's a lot of ground to cover. And then about one-third of that time is spent producing TV shows. It takes 6 days to make one of the TV shows that people see on WILL, as they have for about 20 years now, I think. And we produce about 7 shows a year, a new series of 13 or 14 shows every 2 years.
So these are, and I was just thinking of this as I watched, I think it was a show on a visit to Rome and really look at some of the Roman relics and a bit of the history there. They're not shows you just grind out. It's you spend some time on it.
Well, you know, I can understand somebody grinding a show out if it's just going to show once on a local station or something like that. But these shows, they show everywhere in the United States, and they show, you know, they have a long life because we have 100 shows out now, so a lot of stations cycle them, and they just stay on the air for a long time, and we need to make the shows so that they feel fresh and they don't get dated. And for me, it's just really a passion to take this love of Europe that I have and bring it home and help equip and inspire people to go over to Europe and travel smartly on their own. I found my little niche, and I really love it. For 25 years, I led groups around Europe. Now the group that I lead around is my cameraman and my producer. There's 3 of us on the crew. And we were over there, we have these scripts, and we have 6 days to cover it. Just yesterday in my office, I was sitting down with my France specialist and my producer, and we were debating the best ways to schedule our time in the Ile-de-France and the Loire Valley and how to give a little variety to a show that had too many palaces and churches in it. You know, this is kind of an ongoing challenge of ours to make the shows as interesting and informative as possible. I think it's a good fit for public television. I'm really thankful to be on public television with this because I can, assume an attention span and respect our viewers and our listeners' intellects, and we can make shows that aren't driven by, you know, some advertiser, but just driven by a passion for helping our audience better understand the world.
To join us on air with your travel questions for Rick Steves, you can call us at 333-9455, area code 217, or call toll-free at 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or share your, or give us a tweet or other contact on social media on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us at Focus 580. Rick, I was wondering, how did you get started doing this? It's not like you people major in this sort of thing in college.
Yeah, that's true. I had no idea I was going to do this in college. I was a piano teacher, and I fully expected to be a piano teacher all my life. When I was a kid, my dad dragged me to Europe because he imported pianos from Germany.
Dragged. I just want to note that verb there.
Dragged. I didn't want to go. I was a 14-year-old with a bad attitude. And I got over there, and really on about day two, it occurred to me, this is not all that bad. You know, there's different candy, and there was, I remember there was one-armed bandits in the hotel lobbies. We could gamble. I distinctly remember statuesque women with hairy armpits. And I just said, this is a wonderland, this world of ours. I would have never known it had I not had this opportunity with my dad to bring me over there. And then a couple years later, I remember being in a train station in Copenhagen. We were going between the piano factories in Germany and the relatives up in Norway. And I saw kids about a year, you know, a couple years older than me with rucksacks and Eurail passes and exciting destinations clicking up on the reader board, you know, those old-fashioned reader boards. Copenhagen, Berlin, Amsterdam. And I just looked at my parents and I thought, I don't need you guys for this anymore. And I vowed to go back to Europe every year on my own for the rest of my life, and I have. For the first few years, I was just doing it for kicks. As a piano teacher, kids wouldn't practice in the summer, so I'll see you in September. And then it was really clear I was learning from my mistakes, and I thought if I could just... And what was also clear, other people were making the same mistakes that I learned from the year before. So I thought if I could just package the lessons from these mistakes into a talk or a class or a book or something, others could learn from my mistakes rather than their own have a better trip, and I would have a good excuse to go back to Europe every year and up my material and upgrade my material. And that's what I've been doing now for 30 years. And as I mentioned, I've got this wonderful staff of 80 people, and now technology beyond my wildest dreams to amplify my teaching. And it's just mind-blowing how many trips we can help with the experience we have. So if somebody says you can have 10 days to lay on the beach in Florida, I'd say, no thanks, I'll go to Portugal instead and just work on my guidebook. And because, you know, thousands of people will use that book in the next year, and they'll have better travels. And I have this joy out of connecting people with people. I really see it as what carbonates your travel experience is that people-to-people experience. If I'm making a guidebook or putting one of our tours together, we lead a lot of tours here at my company, or making one of our TV shows for public television, if I don't connect real people with real people, the experience is going to be flat. And that's what really distinguishes your trip. And a big part of my research is finding little mom-and-pop businesses, whether guest houses and bed and breakfast and small hotels or restaurants or tour guides and tour companies over in Europe, and connecting them with my readers. And that's where you get that real intimate connection and, I think, a better value.
And I note I have a copy of Rick Steves' Year Through the Back Door 2013, and I'm struck by that phrase, through the back door. That's an approach you promote. Could you talk more about that?
Well, the whole idea of going through the back door is catching Europe by surprise, just kind of getting it when its guard's down, enjoying the informal welcome. If you go through the front door, you got to pay more, you got to dress up, and you got to mind your manners. But going through the back door, everybody's casual. It's like there's two Europes you can experience. You can be part of the economy, or you can be part of the party. And I like to go to places that have no promotional budgets. And I firmly believe that in so many ways, the less you spend, actually the more you experience. And I can go to Europe, and people who read that book, Europe Through the Back Door, can go to Europe and actually have a much better trip and spend half of what somebody else who just does the conventional way would experience it.
Okay. And, you know, that dovetails into a question a coworker of ours here at WILL sent to me is, how do you balance the joy of sharing great finds in travel with the possibility of overcrowding out-of-way places and destroying their charm? He brought up, and I'm afraid I'm going to mangle the pronunciation, the Cinque Terre,
mm-hmm.
on the Riviera, I think it is.
Or... I said it as well as I could.
Okay. But he thought there might be other examples, too.
Yeah, well, the Cinque Terre is one of my marquee kind of, quote, discoveries. And I discovered it, you know, back in the 70s or the 80s. And when back then it was just a humble group of five little villages, really poor villages, on the most rugged part of the Italian coastline. Put there by pirates centuries ago, hiding out, and even today you can't get a car to some of these towns. They're But thankfully, 100 years ago, they tunneled the train through, and they have little funky little milk-run trains that stop at each of these towns. But there's no comfortable hotels in the towns because the government preserves them, and that's a good thing because it keeps away the most obnoxious slice of the traveling public, people who need comfortable hotels. And it's just some funky little bed and breakfast guest houses and fresh-made local Italian food and beautiful hikes through the vineyards with the Mediterranean glistening, and it's just your quintessential Riviera experience. I absolutely love it. So I discover this, and I start talking about it and put it in TV shows and putting it on the covers of guidebooks and sending everybody there. Today, they're not humble anymore. They're quite wealthy little towns, and there's lots of tourism there. And I'm worried about that a little bit, but I go back every year or so to the Cinque Terre or any of these places I discover, and I check in with the locals, and they're stuttering. They're so happy to see me because of all the business I send them. Talk to the tourists. They're having a blast. And then a few people who I meet say, why did you have to tell everybody about this? Why didn't you just send me an email so I could be here alone? You know, it's an odd sort of thing, but my job is I'm the hired hand of my American readers. I go over there and I find places that are undiscovered, and I try to organize the information and prepare people and send them there to experience and enjoy it on their vacation. You know, tourism is an important part of economies all across Europe, so everybody loves to get the business, and it's not cheap to travel even at these kind of places. I do have to be careful that I don't, I mean, the reality is you can trample the charm of a place and it becomes a zoo. And, you know, that is an issue very occasionally. But, you know, successful as my books are, the mainstream tourism, you know, the big tour groups that stop at Killarney in Ireland or Oberammergau in Germany or Stratford in England, you know, they're just much more destructive to a place's charm than a bunch of independent American travelers with a guidebook that they're following. So, you know, I do my best to find these exciting places, and then assuming they want the crowds and assuming they can handle the tourism, I send people there. But, you know, if you're looking to not see any other Americans, if you go to my very most popular places, you'll see a lot of people with my books there.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're talking about travel, the whys and wherefores of it with Rick Steves. You can hear him Saturdays at noon on Travel with Rick Steves on WILL AM 580. Watch him Saturdays at 5:30 p.m. on Rick Steves Europe on WILL TV. I want to take a phone call now, and I want to say good morning to Zarina in Champaign. Hello, you're on the air on Focus.
Hello, Rick Steves. First of all, I want to tell you I absolutely love your guidebooks, and I never travel without them. And I love the way you celebrate and see the positive qualities in other cultures.
Thank you very much. That's sort of our mission, is to not be afraid of diversity, but to celebrate it.
Yeah.
And to learn from people and assume they find different truths to be self-evident and God-given.
Yeah, and now comes my question. I'm from India, and I don't need a guidebook for India, but I often wonder why you haven't ventured more into the non-Western world, and why not a guidebook on India?
Well, it's funny, because India really is my favorite country. I absolutely love India, and on the other hand, for one thing, India is a very personal thing, to go to India. I wouldn't want to treat India from a tourism point of view like I can treat Ireland or Italy or Germany, where I can just say, go to this museum, then go over here, and then eat that. India is so, it resonates with people so differently. And apart from that, I've decided to keep a focus on Europe. For me, Europe is the waiting pool for world exploration, and I want to be the coach for Americans who are just getting the nerve and the determination together to get out of our country and stop going back to Hawaii or Cancun every year, and to really immerse themselves in these faraway countries. So I'm keeping a focus on Europe. I'd love to do more places, but it's hard to be really reliable and up-to-date, and Europe's a big beat, and I sort of made a promise to myself that I would just be Mr. Europe for American travelers, and I'm determined to do that.
Thank you.
Yeah, but you're from a very beautiful country. I just dream about going back to India.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, bye.
Yep.
Thank you very much, caller. And would you recommend books about India and the Indian subcontinent?
Sure. For sure. I write guidebooks on Europe, but I'm the first one to say a guidebook is a $20 tool for a $3,000 experience. And you're just classic penny wise and pound foolish if you go anywhere outside of our country without a good guidebook. I'm going to Egypt next month, and I have not written anything on Egypt, and I've bought a couple of great books on Egypt. You know, I like the Lonely Planet series. I like the DK series. There's a lot of one-off, writers. I'm interviewing somebody on my radio show later this week who's written a book called Fast Times in Palestine, and she lived there for a few years and wrote a great guidebook. And not all these guidebooks are just listings of hotels and restaurants. A lot of them offer cultural insights. The more you read and prepare before your trip, the better your trip will go. I mean, I've been teaching this for 30 years, and it's really clear to me. If people can just expect themselves to travel smart, well, equip themselves with good information, and then expect themselves to travel smart, they can. That's our challenge. I mean, there's so many ways that you can make your trip better if you just have information. Recently halfway up the Eiffel Tower looking down at the crowds. There's a long snaking line, probably an hour and a half long to get under the elevator to go up the Eiffel Tower. I had just walked through a empty line of stanchions, walked right to the front of the line. They escorted me to the front and put me directly onto the elevator because I had a guidebook, happened to be my guidebook, but it could have been any guidebook, that explained how you need to make a reservation in advance, either by calling or going to the website. And then you make an appointment and you come in, and you get to go to the front of the line. There are, you know, I walked along that whole snaking, long, tired, frustrated line of tourists, and not one of them had the Rick Steves Paris book. They were all just fumbling around Europe without using a guidebook. And it occurred to me there's two IQs of European travelers, those who wait in lines and those who don't wait in lines. If you're waiting in line, you're messing up. Generally, those lines are not to get into the site, but they are to buy a ticket to get into the site. And there are ways to get tickets that don't involve going there and standing in line. And that's the trick for us travelers, is to get those tickets in those alternative ways. And then we go directly to the front. In the case of Paris, I think one of my favorite, probably the most compliments I get for a single travel tip is when I encourage people to get the Paris Museum Pass. You know, it costs $50 and it's good for a couple of days. Pays for itself in three admissions. But the main thing is you walk right to the front of the line at the Sainte-Chapelle, at the Orangerie, at the Orsay, at the Louvre, at Versailles. You walk right to the front of the line, and you're up there before the people in the back of the line get to the front of that line, and that really is the great reason to get those museum passes that cities all over Europe sell.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're discussing travel with travel expert Rick Steves. To join our conversation, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Or send a question or comment at Facebook and Twitter. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. Let's go to a caller now from Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. I really like your attitude. One of the things that I've learned that I enjoy about travel is just seeing how people live in little surprises when you're just walking around streets trying to get from one place to another, or restaurants you stop in at because it's convenient and you think, I'll give it a shot. A lot of the stuff you can buy is postcards or see in travel books, and it's the other stuff that makes it much more intimate. But my question has to do with travel in Ireland. We're hoping to go with relationship to a conference in Dublin and then do some digging up of ancestors, and I figured out where two of them are from, but one's in the middle of Ireland, in independent Ireland, and one's across the border in County Tyrone, and somebody else farther back is up in Donegal, and I'm just wondering how easy it is to, and I figure we'll probably need to rent a car, how easy it is to move across borders in a place like that. And we're probably going to be going, when I see there are some festivals in Northern Ireland about Orangemen and such. So, we've got Catholic ancestors and Protestant ancestors who ended up, their descendants ended up marrying. What kind of political trouble am I going to get myself into?
Well, when you talk about crossing borders, you're talking about going from the Republic of Ireland into Northern Ireland?
Correct.
Yeah, it's just like crossing any border. It's not very involved these days. And you'll hardly know when you've crossed the border in most cases. As far as going into the north, how safe is it and everything, I think it's perfectly safe. Especially if you compare it to what it's like to live in the United States. It's just common sense when you're in Ireland is not to wear the wrong colors. You wouldn't want to wear orange colors in a Catholic pub or green colors in a Protestant pub. So you might just want to kind of stay out of those politically charged kind of environments if there's an orange parade going on. These orange parades are, you know, the Protestants up in the north, they have a way to excuse them, but to me they feel very hateful. And I've been to some of them, and they're perfectly safe to witness. And it is, for me, fascinating to watch how the older generation instills this fear and this traditional sort of determination to defend their way of life against whatever might want to be more pluralistic or whatever. And you just feel that it's transferring down to the little kids who are marching in that same parade. Having said that, I love going to the north of Ireland for the warm welcome you get and a chance to see just a different dimension of Ireland. And there's nothing, you know, if you use common sense, there's nothing dangerous or reckless about it, and rich rewards by talking to people and getting a firsthand sense of what is going on, what are the dynamics in Irish society today, which is much, much more, let's talk about it, than it used to be. As far as looking for your relatives and so on, it sounds like you're basing in Dublin, then you've got to go out to Donegal and into the center of the country. It's a small island, but the roads are kind of small, and I think the public transportation is some of the worst in Europe. I think it's best to have your own rental car. That would make a lot of sense. Then you'd get a lot more accomplished. But I just absolutely love Ireland. You'll be the most popular kid in town when you come into town and let it be known that you're a relative, distant as you may be. The Irish just love to have, Irish Americans come back to the old country and check in. So have fun with that. That'll be great.
I saw on an American Airlines magazine that there are some people who specialize in helping people do groundwork for genealogical trips, specifically looking for your own records, and I thought that was an interesting specialization, and I haven't used personal tour guides before, but I'm thinking about doing that for
Oh, I don't know specifically about genealogy tour guides, but I do know that having a tour guide, for whatever reason, it just empowers you, and I'm going to Europe for 120 days this coming season. And I'll have private guides probably 70 or 80 of those days, and all of them will be time and money well spent, and half of them will be good enough for me to recommend them and put them in my guidebook so other people can email them and line them up. Remember, all over Europe, private guides are just hardworking historians and guides and so on that are trying to cobble together a livelihood, and for a couple $100, you can sign them up for the better part of a day, and you have your local expert to show you around. If you have a car, that's fine. They can hop in for you. Sometimes they come with their own cars. But if you have a mission, that might open some doors for you. Also, I don't know the specifics in Ireland, but I know in other countries they have immigration centers where you can go. And, the bottom floor would just be a museum about that group of people. But upstairs would be all sorts of research facilities where people can go and really put their family roots together. So that should be fun. And in Ireland, of course, you're going to be enjoying no language barrier. But also, you know, one of the reasons I think I like Ireland so much is I get the sensation that I'm understanding a foreign language. Everybody has this wonderful lilt and this creative way of talking, this artful gift of gab, just a love of conversation. And they love to talk. And it's like you hear about the gift of gab and you get there and you think, God, you know, people just throw their itineraries out the window and settle into a good conversation. Especially on the west coast of Ireland. If you go way to the west of Ireland, stand on the bluff and look out at the Atlantic where people gaze out at sea and say, the next parish over is Boston. And you get into a conversation with people out there. These are Gaeltachts where the government is funding and subsidizing the continued survival of the traditional ways of life. You'll find Ireland in the extreme, and for any Irish American going back to the old country, I think this is really great. Do remember there's a lot more to you're finding your heritage than looking up names on tombstones and stuff, just to better understand that culture. There's everything in Ireland is just laid out beautifully for visitors, so I hope they have a great time.
Yeah, I agree about being in a place and just getting some feeling of the culture. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Thank you. You're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous Focus program. We'll talk more after a short break. We're back with Focus on WYLL AM 580. I'm Jim Meadows, and you're listening to an encore edition of Focus. We're not taking live phone calls this hour, but we welcome your feedback on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. My guest today is Rick Steves, who fell in love with traveling at an early age and wants you to fall in love with it, too. We have plenty of callers waiting to talk to Rick, and let me go to our next one. And we're talking to Kathy in Odell, Illinois. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Hi, Rick. It's fun to talk to you.
Hi, Kathy.
I've used your books and information for many years, and I just wanted to talk about going deep a little bit. I'm one of those people. I go to France every year. I've been going for 12 years. My kids were on foreign exchange there, and they got me started and taught me how to get around. And I've done some wonderful things meeting people there. I kind of do it on a shoestring. And I wonder if you've ever heard of or been to the Salon d'Agriculture, which is at Port Versailles, a big exposition that the French have every year.
No, what's that like?
Well, it's wonderful. It's usually at the end of February or the end and into March. And it is a cultural exhibition of all the areas of France. And it's, I always say it's like a taste of Chicago, because there's all this food,
yeah,
a flower show, and an agricultural, you know, 4-H fair, because they bring the cows in, they milk the cows there every day, and then they sell the milk. And it is for the Parisian and people to come and see the rest of France. It's absolutely wonderful.
That sounds like a utopian opportunity for anybody curious in their travels about the diversity and the salt of the earth kind of culture of France.
Oh, yeah. You get to try foods from all the different areas. They have restaurants and all the specialties, Aligo and all these. I've had Calvados and wonderful things there. So I spend time in Paris and wander the city, mostly walking and visiting smaller sites. I've seen all the big ones and go back to some of those. But getting to know the people, and have found people there to be quite delightful.
Yeah. Hey, if you are so inclined, I would love to share that Salon d'Agriculture with my travelers.
Yes.
Every February. I normally don't cover the festivals because I'm writing for people who are going any time of year. But I've got a Facebook page, and if you ever just sent me a little
I will.
On Facebook,
I'll send you something about it.
If you want to write that up, I'd love to share that with people.
And this year, for the first, I usually go in the spring because I want to catch the high tides at Mont-Saint-Michel. I do my little out-and-about things.
Mm-hmm.
And I spend a lot of time with the Bayou Tapestry because I'm a needleworker. But but I also would mention that this year I went in November, and at the same exposition site they have something called the Salon de Chocolat. And it was kind of the same thing, only every booth was about chocolate.
Nice. Whoa.
And that was the end of October. Pretty wonderful also.
Kathy, if you're into needlework, have you seen the Unicorn Tapestry?
Oh, every year. That's one of my places I go.
We just visited that with our TV camera, and it was one of the most sexy, beautiful things to ever film. And it was out of the Middle Ages. And we just featured it with this beautiful, glorious high definition. We were all alone in there. And it was an amazing thing about sensuousness in the Middle Ages, which was kind of coming out of the dark. And this it's a series of tapestries from 800 years ago or something like that, and just was
sumptuous.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite places to go. But the Bayou Tapestry in Bayou is really where I always go. And,
well, that's the inspiration historically, isn't it?
It's incredible. And the way it survived through the centuries is almost a story in itself.
And the way they present it for travelers, you know, the French are really good and thoughtful about lighting things and providing, audio guides so you can listen in different languages and see the story. That tapestry, it's actually embroidery, right? And it's supposed to be about 50 yards long, and you walk along the wall.
220 feet long and 20 inches high, and it's just amazing.
And it's like a big, long comic strip, and it tells the story of the invasion of the Normans of England.
Yeah,
And you just get right into that mindset, and you can see the king with the arrow in his eye and the Viking-type ships crossing the straits, and it's just thrilling. And that's one of the joys of traveling. It sounds like you've really got a nice level of travel for France.
Yeah, it is. And the thing is now, I really go back to my favorite places. Dinan, the little walled city, Dinan, is one that I just wander back to over and over. I like to see something new every year. I've been to Bruges, and I go to Switzerland often because I have relatives there. But this is just like France draws me back. And I have made friends now with guides in some of the places, and some of the waiters remember me.
Do you hire private guides?
No. Just like at Mont Saint-Michel, one
oh,
of the
guides,
guides
yeah.
I've met.
Oh, guides,
yeah.
You meet these wonderful.
We have lunch together when I go now. So getting to know the people there is probably, to me, one of the most important things. And one of the draws back is I want to go back and see those friends I've made, as well as this garden.
But, Kathy, you're talking about French people. I thought the French people were so unfriendly.
Oh, no.
Isn't that funny? A lot of people think the French are unfriendly, but when you get there, you find out, what's with that? As long as you're curious about their culture and you don't try to turn them into Americans, I think it'll be just fine.
They know that. They sense that pretty quickly. And I've had people help me out, you know, when I'm lost and different things. Parisians don't really like anybody. They don't like French people that much. People shouldn't take it personally, but I don't know.
And a lot of Americans go to Paris in the middle of the summer when anybody who can afford it gets out of there, and the Parisians who are left are dealing with Americans putting ketchup on their meat and butchering their language and asking them to change a 50-euro note for a subway ticket. And it's, sometimes they're not the most polite in that sense. But especially if you get out into the countryside, learn a few French words and become a cultural chameleon, eat and drink what local people are eating and drinking and be steep on the learning curve and not judgmental and not comparing it back to things back at home, you know. I think you're going to just find a wonderful welcome there.
I think so. And I think one of the most amazing things to me that I feel with the French people is they're so into quality of life. I mean,
that's what we can
go
learn
to
here.
The markets and it's important. And we forget that here.
Yeah. See, in France, I find people want to pay too much for their bread to buy it from the person who baked it. And I like that. It's part of the fabric of their community. They have that sort of commitment to their neighborhood and everything, and they will consume, I think, in a way that they recognize helps shape the society they live in, whereas Americans generally often have high ideals, but it comes right down to it. We will buy our whatever we want to buy where it's the cheapest, and that sort of works against our ideals for how we want our community to evolve, and I can learn a lot from the Europeans in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, and enjoy.
Yeah,
enjoy
and happy travels for you. I hope that when you're in Paris next time, you can use my audio tours. I have a set of free audio tours. We have an app called Rick Steves Audio Europe.
Hey, I grew up in Chicago area. Uh-huh. I know Paris better than I know
Chicago.
Oh,
that's good. Then you got it set.
Two places in Paris.
All right.
Been to.
Hey, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you very much, caller. Let me share an email that came in from Al, and he's asking, he's explaining first that after graduating from college last year, I spent the summer traveling Europe with my unlimited EuroRail pass and religiously following your guidebook, Europe Through the Back Door. As the youth fare is very reasonable, what economical options, train travel-wise, would I have as I get older? The adult fare passes are significantly more expensive than the youth fares.
Well, you're right, Al. When you get 26 or over 26, they figure you got more money, and they're going to charge you about double. Of course, you go first class instead of second class, which is worth a little more, too. But, if you're under 26, you can get that youth rail pass, which is a great value. Basically, rail passes, it depends on how much traveling you're going to do, if they're worth the trouble and the expense or not. If you're going to really do a lot of traveling and base your trip on the rails, then I think rail passes can be a great value. Even if you only break even on it, it's a convenience to have a rail pass because it saves you a lot of trips to the station to buy tickets and so on. The notion is just hop onto a train. These days, there's a lot of special trains that require reservations, so it's not quite as freewheeling as it used to be. And these days, you have discount airlines, which are actually cheaper than train tickets and bus tickets in a lot of cases. So because of that, I find myself using fewer rail passes these days and point-to-point tickets, car rental here and there, and then flying. I'm just, when you structure your itinerary, there's where you get to set the kind of parameters. I just yesterday bought my ticket for my next trip. I'm flying into Cairo, and I'm flying out of Seville in southern Spain, and then I'll be flying from Cairo to Israel, from Israel to Istanbul, from Istanbul to Rome, and from Milan to Granada. So those are like 4 one-way flights within that trip. And it costs, about $100 per flight in Europe these days. If you're really a good, serious, aggressive budget traveler, you can book these discount airlines much, much cheaper. And that's just using a search engine and finding the very cheapest discount airline. But I generally just go with scheduled airlines I get through my travel agent, and I'm happy to fly point-to-point in Europe for about $100. With a trip like that, with all those single airfare flights, are one-way flights, you wouldn't really need a Eurail pass. On the other hand, if I was flying in and out of Amsterdam and just going to do all the famous stuff in 30 days and I was going to take the train, you would save a lot of money just by buying that Eurail pass. So it depends on your itinerary.
And Al writes that the best advice we received from your books was utilizing the Superfast ferry for free transport from Italy to Greece, which is included in the Eurail fee.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. In fact, it's been 10 years since I flew in and out of the same city. I think it makes sense to fly open jaws. For instance, somebody like Al could fly into Amsterdam or Paris, and they could fly home from Athens or Istanbul, and then you could use your Eurail for all of the continent, and you could use your Eurail for the included and expensive boat ride from Italy to Greece, and then in Greece, let your train pass expire where you don't want it clicking away anyways because you're going to be hanging out in the islands where there's no trains to use, and then finish things off with a flurry through Turkey and fly home from Istanbul. That would be a very cool open jaws flight using a Eurail pass smartly.
Let's go ahead and take another call. This is a call coming in from Jan in Danville. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Oh, hello. I'm very pleased to be able to talk to you, Rick. I'm also someone who grew up in and around Chicago. I've traveled a lot since 60-plus years old and have gone in the United States to see family members mostly. But I'm very comfortable using all kinds of public transportation and whatnot. But now I find a family member is established in the town of Linz, Austria. And I want to go visit for about a week or so. We'll fly from O'Hare over to Vienna and spend about a week in Linz. And I wondered if you have any words of wisdom about spending a week there.
Well, Linz, Austria it's just a kind of a workaday town on the Danube River, just a couple hours upriver from the great city of Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
Linz is famous only because that was Hitler's hometown.
Mm-hmm.
Nearby, you've got a number of very interesting sites. Passau is another town just up the river from there where they have a famous pipe organ. You can go to the Wachau River Valley, which is the charming part of the Danube. The romantic part of the Danube is called the Wachau Valley, from Krems to Melk, K-R-E-M-S to M-E-L-K. And also from Linz, you could take... The great thing about Europe's train system is it enables you to scoot into this or that city and just day trip in. But if you've got your home base in Linz, you could side trip into Vienna. Vienna would be by far the most important or interesting thing nearby. Mm-hmm. You're also within striking distance of Salzburg. And if you are in a World War II and Holocaust frame of mind, the powerful, very powerful concentration camp at Mauthausen is very nearby, and that would be even a more powerful experience than Dachau for a lot of people, I think. So there's plenty to see and do near Linz, L-I-N-Z, in Austria.
Yes. Is that covered in one of your tour books?
Yes. I write a guidebook for Austria. It's actually called Rick Steves' Vienna and Salzburg, but it covers all of the side trips on the Danube that you're talking about there. And I've got a guidebook for Germany that would cover places just north of Linz in Germany. But the great thing about that part of Europe is the wonderful train system, and you've got these historic towns nearby, and there's so much to see. I would remind you, Jan, once you get over there, even if you have a free place to stay in Linz, don't hesitate to overnight in cities nearby. I mean, nearby you've got Munich, you've got Salzburg, you've got Nuremberg, you've got Vienna, all wonderful places. And actually, within a couple of hours, you could be down in Italy, and you could go to Venice. A lot of Americans underestimate what's within striking distance in Europe because we have much bigger distances in the United States, and we don't have the public transportation that makes things so easy that you'll find in Europe.
Okay. So we could use a train to get to Venice?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. I'll go look in the book.
Have fun with your trip. Yeah.
Bye.
Thank you very much, caller. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for your questions or comments for travel expert Rick Steves at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL, or toll free at 800-222-WILL. One of our phone callers who couldn't stay on the line but, however, did leave a message through our board operator was asking about how travel has changed in the decades since 9/11, how travel has changed for Americans.
Oh, you know, I think 9/11 does not even matter. Americans are so excited about 9/11, but that's old news now. I hate to say it. We lost 2,800 people. We're a mighty nation of 300 million. It was a tragic thing. I don't want to make light of it, but the world has moved on from 9/11, and you know, it's very nice for Americans to get outside and see what the other 96% of humanity is up to. And I don't think travel has changed at all since 9/11, except Americans have a different kind of heritage that they consider. Every country has its baggage. Every country has 9/11 baggage, and the United States does too. But from a travel point of view, 12 million Americans go to Europe every year. 12 million come back. There hasn't been a terrorist event in Europe for, I don't think, since 9/11. And even if there was tomorrow a terrorist event in Europe, I don't think it would really matter compared to from a safety point of view, because in the United States, you know, we lose 1,000 people every month to handguns, and we just accept it as a way of living. You can make a case that that's a small price to pay or a reasonable price to pay for the right to bear arms, and that's a whole different discussion. But in Europe, they decide not to have weapons, and they lose one-tenth of the people that we do to violence on their streets. So Europe is a very safe place. Europe wrote the book on security. They've been dealing with terrorism since I was a little kid. And I don't think 9/11 even matters to European travel.
In terms of, I hear in that in that discussion something about the safety aspects. Just in the past decade, with the American military presences in Afghanistan, in Iraq, the disagreements between different countries and the people of different countries about doing that, how has that changed travel, especially in Europe, as far as how American visitors are regarded?
Well, I think you're talking, Jim, about any sort of anti-American sentiment that somebody might experience when they're traveling outside of our borders. And we have to remember that, you know, every country is sovereign. Every country has its own military problems and history and challenges, and every country has its own fears. And we need to know not what we think, but what the other 96% of humanity sees when they look at us. If you see an anti-American, if you see a flag defaced or a down with USA sticker or something like that anywhere in your travels in Europe, it's not anti-American you or me. It's not anti-American ideals. People love and respect and admire American ideals. I find that those anti-American graffitis and sentiments are anti-American militarism and anti-American trade policy. Now, you may think, or one of our listeners may think, that our trade policy is compassionate and beautiful, and we may think all of our wars and all of our militarism is well-founded, but other people disagree, and we just need to respect that. I think, you know, we're dealing with a lot of budget issues right now in our country, and we have the horror of cutting our military, and we can't imagine how we can survive without a stronger military. Well, we should remind ourselves that our country, which is 4% of this planet, spends as much as everybody else put together on our military. And apparently you can't even get elected without promising more for the military in this country. And other people look at us and they just shake their heads and think we're addicted to military spending. Half of the world is trying to live on $2 a day. Half of humanity trying to live on $2 a day. And we got our economic crisis, you know, and we're only growing at 2% a year. Most of the world wishes they had our problem. I don't want to belittle somebody's struggles if they're unemployed or something, but I think if there is a problem in our society, it would be more a problem of distribution than of overall societal economic struggles. When you look at, you know, issues around the world, a lot of them are dealt with in the United Nations. And when the United Nations has a vote about something that really is important to the desperate half of humanity, those people trying to live on $2 a day, our country is outvoted 140-4. Routinely, 150 times a year, there's an election in the United Nations where the nations come together and try to deal with these issues in the developing world, and it's 140-4 with the United States in the minority. Who stands with us? Israel, Marshall Islands, and Micronesia. It's very interesting to go to the United Nations website and just look at the votes. It sounds hard to believe, but that's just the case. So a lot of countries are angry with our trade policy, and that's what frustrates people. When I leave Christiania, which is a hippie squatters community up in Copenhagen, where they smoke a lot of pot. My friends say there, be very careful with your marijuana here in Denmark, because every year in Denmark we have to arrest a couple of pot smokers in order to maintain favored trade status with the United States of America. So that's just one little odd example of how an American trade law, we made a treaty where everybody signed, where everybody has to wage trade sanctions on a country that decides to legalize marijuana. that's just one thing that, you know, and there's other ones too, that frustrate locals. And when we travel, we get to learn about that. And that's one of the great things I find about travel. So the main thing to answer your question is, if you see anybody who doesn't like something about the United States, it's not against you or me as individuals, and it's certainly not against what makes America great. American values are respected and held high all around the world. It's trade policy, and it's their perceived take on our militarism.
Let's go ahead to another caller for Rick Steves, and we're talking to somebody from Piatt County. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Okay, Rick, I'm sure you hear this a lot, but it's just a strong sense of gratitude because I hadn't traveled for a very long time, and my friend and I went to Germany in 2011 in the fall after Oktoberfest, and we ended up, we went down from Munich down into the Alps, and it was just incredible with your book. But I did want to say to anybody who goes to that area, we stayed at the Hotel Maximilian.
Well, you did.
Isn't that near Einbeckel, if I'm pronouncing it correctly? We just ended up there so randomly, and I've got to tell you, it was just an incredible experience. And talked to Gabby, and then we ended up in Rotenburg and took another year of recommendations to a crazy restaurant where the guy plays American music all the time.
Yeah, the fun of my work is to find those kind of places in my guidebooks. Gabby has been a friend of mine for 20 years, and I love it when my readers get to go to her little hotel.
Well, I love it. It was such a different experience, and you just felt, so far away from America, which of course feels good sometimes.
Well,
with Gabby,
it's kind of like the Trapp Family Singers. The whole family is singing, and Grandma and Grandpa are there, and it's just there's three generations running the hotel.
Yes, and they brought in an old organ player for one of the dinners, and he brought his little organ. It's very, very interesting, and so I just want to thank you very much.
And didn't you find that they were joyful in sharing their culture with travelers from far away?
Oh, yes, there was a whole group of people from India there, and it was just a business group, and it was just a very warm and fun place.
Now, Jim asked me earlier what was going through the back door, and when you went to Reutte instead of Fussen, and stayed at Hotel Maximilian and met Gabby and her family, that's going through the back door. Most of the Americans would stay in a big hotel in Germany by Mad Ludwig's castle. But you decided to go over the border into Austria, a more humble community without the promotional budget, and get to know a family. And to me, that gives you the richly rewarding travel experience that we're talking about right now.
Yes, and I'm very grateful to you. So I just wanted to thank you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Thank you, caller. I'm going to try to see if I can get in one more call here on Focus with Rick Steves.
Hey, Jim, if I could just take a moment to remind people that I'm really excited about I made an app that gives people all of the tours, and it designs all of our radio interviews that people have heard on WILL over the last 6 or 7 years into country-specific playlists. And they can download this and have it as an arsenal of information when they're in Europe and listen to it when they're offline. It's completely free, and it really is a godsend. If somebody wants the tours that I like to lead around Europe, you can get all the tours to all the great sites and walks in London, Paris, Venice, Florence, Rome, and so on, if they just get the Rick Steves Audio Europe app. And if they're curious about that and more about it, they can get all the details at our website at ricksteves.com.
That's ricksteves.com. Let's go ahead now to Al in Peoria. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Rick, we're going to go on an architectural tour in Finland in May. We're going to have 4 days in Helsinki with some free time. What shouldn't we miss?
30 seconds, Rick.
You're going to be in Finland, and you got some free time. You know, an hour and a half away is Estonia, Tallinn, the capital of Estonia. If you had a day to go over to Estonia, that would be wonderful. Otherwise, if you're just in Finland, go out to the neighborhoods where you can find a neighborhood sauna. Rich people and tourists and hotels all have their own saunas now. But in the poor neighborhoods, people still go down the street to the corner sauna, and you can get naked and soak in the steam with all the local Finns, and that is an experience you'll never forget.
Rick Steves is the host of Travel with Rick Steves, Saturdays at noon on WILL AM 580, and Rick Steves Europe, Saturdays at 5:30 p.m. on WILL TV. I'm Jim Meadows, and you've been listening to an encore presentation of Focus on WILL. Tune in for conversations about issues and ideas that affect your life each weekday morning at 10, with a replay at 8 p.m. We welcome any additional comments or questions you have about today's show on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of the Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Jason Croft is our technical director. You can always find free downloadable podcasts of the show on our website, and you can also find Focus on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. That's Focus numbers 580. This is Focus on WYLL AM 580.